allow people to vote, and then they count the vote. If they can't, so observing that they're not likely to win if they do that, they've decided that they're going to tear down the elemental democratic arrangements that we have in the United States. It is so horrifying and so important that we rally to defend basic democratic rights. It's not that these always work. It's not that they're perfect. It's not that they aren't corrupted. They are, all those things. Nevertheless, they help to humanize American society. It is a good thing that people vote. And more people actually do vote. And that's good, but we have to protect it because there is actually a concerted effort to dismantle democracy. Republicans and the property
class. We have 10 seconds.
Have perceived that they're no longer popular. And because they're no longer popular, they're going to smash the arrangements through which people express themselves in the American political system and have some influence.
Frances Fox Bevan, we thank you so much for being with us. Longtime social movement scholar, distinguished professor emerita of political science sociology at CUNY Grad Center. Again, a very happy 90th birthday. That does it for our show. We have two full-time job openings. Check democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, longtime Beaverton Mayor Denny Doyle pleads guilty to possessing child pornography. The U.S. Supreme Court could hear a case about the desecration of a sacred indigenous site on Mount Hood. And Portland Thorns and Timbers owner Merritt Paulson steps down. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for October 11th, 2022. I'm Eric Leuschner. Former Beaverton Mayor Denny Coyle pled guilty to one count of child pornography possession today. He had digital files containing child pornography, including of minors under 12, between November 2014 and December 2015. Doyle was the mayor of Beaverton from 2009 to 2021. Some of the images were identified to be sexually exploited minors by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, according to prosecutors. With this felony conviction, Doyle will never be able to vote or hold public office again. He is 74 years old. On the way out of the courthouse, Doyle said, quote, "You know, we make mistakes." Doyle will be sentenced January 24th and remains out of custody until his sentencing date. The U.S. Supreme Court could hear a case about a desecrated indigenous site on Mount Hood. Elders from the Yakima Nation and the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde have sued agencies involved with a highway project that destroyed the site in 2008. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
Tribal elders are asking the United States Supreme Court to intervene in a case revolving around a desecrated site on Mount Hood. The site, which sits in a forest off Highway 26, about 13 miles from government camp, involves burial grounds. The elders likened it to a church without walls. They have told lower courts they would visit the sacred burial ground to remember their ancestors and to pray to their creator near a stone altar surrounded by old-growth trees. The site, known as Anaquana Nichi Nichi Patat, meaning place of big trees, was destroyed by a highway expansion project in 2008. Members of the Yakima Nation and Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde sued the agencies involved in the highway project, claiming bulldozing the site violated their rights to religious freedom. But two lower courts dismissed their case, based at least partly on the 11th Amendment, which blocks federal courts from having jurisdiction over state defendants. Tribal members say they told state and federal transportation officials about the religious value of the site before the agency started building a left-turn lane off the highway. The highway expansion proceeded anyway, involving the removal of trees and the stone altar, and covering the burial grounds with a large embankment. The U.S. Department of Transportation, Bureau of Land Management, and Oregon Department of Transportation said the turn lane was needed for safety following nearby traffic accidents, one of which was fatal. The elders went to court, arguing the destruction of the site violated their rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which prohibits state and federal agencies from burdening a person's exercise of religion and the Freedom Exercise Clause of the Constitution, which protects the right to practice religion. The goal is for the federal agencies to remove the embankment, replant trees, and allow the stone altar to be reconstructed. The original lawsuit took place in 2008. At that time, a district court decided that the highway project did not put a meaningful burden on the tribal members' religious freedom. The case was put on hold for years while the parties tried to negotiate a settlement, but those efforts stalled. A federal appeals court dismissed the case. Appealing the case to the federal Supreme Court is a last resort for tribal members. Luke Goodrich, an attorney representing the plaintiffs, said, quote, "Religious freedom in this country means the government tries to do whatever it can to refrain from prohibiting your religious practices. The question in this case is, will Native Americans receive the same kind of legal protection for their religious practices that everybody else in the country already gets?" End quote. The Supreme Court will decide by January whether or not it will hear the case. The U.S. Department of Transportation and the Oregon Department of Transportation have declined to comment. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. One scam on the rise is known as smishing, where fraudsters use text messages to steal people's information. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and one new scamming method people need to be on the lookout for is smishing. The word smishing comes from a combination of SMS, another name for text messaging, and phishing. Scammers use text messages to try and steal people's personal information. Matthew Wilson is Vice President of Risk and Administration at Oregon Community Credit Union. He says fraudsters have a couple different ways to scam people with smishing messages.
Send you a message that is either going to ask you directly for information, send you to a website to have you put in information there, or to deliver some malware payload onto your device.
Wilson says the financial industry has seen a notable increase in smishing scams. The U.S. Secret Service has also issued an alert that these types of scams are on the rise. Jessa Womack, Information Security Manager at Oregon Community Credit Union, says the urgency conveyed in these messages can scare people into responding.
Any message that you get that has an action item, just kind of take a deep breath, see if it makes sense to you. And you can always go directly to the website that you're suspicious of something going on.
Womack says there are a couple of ways people can protect themselves. She suggests folks enable multi-factor authentication for their financial accounts so that logging in requires a password and either a text message or call. People should also monitor their bank accounts for suspicious activity. Wilson says if something doesn't look right, they should act quickly.
The fraudsters and scammers out there, they're making victims out of all of us, and we can all fall for a really well-crafted either email or SMS message. Don't be embarrassed about it. Pick up the phone, start calling your financial institutions, check your credit reports, and allow us to help you.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The owner of the Portland Thorns and Timbers, Merritt Paulson, will step down. This comes after a year-long report from outside the National Women's Soccer League that found Paulson helped minimize, obscure, and hide the allegations of sexual coercion and manipulation against a one-time Thorns head coach, Paul Riley. His actions likely allowed Riley to continue to be a coach in National Women's Soccer for more than 6 years. Paulson is under significant pressure from Portland fans to sell both of the soccer teams. Players and sponsors have also voiced support for ending his involvement with the organization. He's stepping down as CEO and will certainly reduce his day-to-day role with the Thorns and Timbers, but Paulson would continue to be a league owner. He and his father are some of the most active members in Major League Soccer governance. The commissioner has the power to sanction, fine, or suspend Paulson under certain criteria, but Major League Soccer has not yet announced any punishment for Paulson. Farmworkers from Northwest Washington are touring the state in an effort to bring better conditions to the profession. Eric Tegedoff has more from the organizers.
Farmworkers are touring Washington state to call for better conditions in agriculture. The union Familias Unidas por la Justicia, based in Northwest Washington, has organized the tour, which started on Sunday. It's scheduled to be in Seattle today, then traveling to Olympia and Wenatchee. Marciano Sanchez is an organizer with the union. He says participants on the tour are calling out the Farm Workforce Modernization Act in Congress for its expansion of the H-2A program, which allows temporary visas to farm workers from other countries. Sanchez says the program is exploitative.
They can't just go on to a different farm and start working there for better wages. If they bring up any issues that they have, complaints, whether they don't have water, they're not getting paid well enough, they can get fired right away and they have to figure out how to get back to their hometown.
Supporters of the H-2A program say it's needed because of a shortage of domestic workers. The U.S. Department of Labor certified more than 300,000 temporary jobs through the H-2A program in 2021. The tour is heading to Spokane and the Tri-Cities and ending on Friday in Yakima. Sanchez says farmers also would like to see improvements to Washington State's heat rules, which require employers to allow more rest periods if temperatures are 89 degrees or higher. But he says that threshold is too high.
When you're wearing clothing that retains heat, 80, 90 degree weather can jump to 100 plus just because the clothing that you have to wear to protect yourself from all the chemicals that get sprayed onto those fruits.
Sanchez also notes the tour is happening on Indigenous Peoples Day, celebrated on the second Monday of October.
A lot of our members here in Skagit County, they're from Indigenous backgrounds of Mixteco, Triqui, so it just worked out perfectly.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Organizations are sending truckloads of relief supplies to help those who were caught in Hurricane Ian. The Category 4 storm with 155-mile-an-hour winds left many communities devastated and more than 100 deaths, most of them in the southwest of Florida. Tramell Gomes has more.
For some in hurricane-ravaged southwest Florida, recovery has been relatively quick. However, as of Saturday, there were still some 69,000 reported power outages and thousands more displaced people. Businesses are opening back up and families are slowly continuing to make their way back to their homes or what remains when they arrive. Along with power restoration, access to clean water and basic needs are still issues that state emergency managers are hoping to fix quickly. Groups such as the Florida AFL-CIO have banded together with other unions across the state to help out. Operations manager Helen Parker says they used to provide financial support, but quickly realized after one storm to the next that financials are only nice if you can use them.
So instead of giving out financial gift cards of small value, we are now transporting, we have ice, a semi-truck of ice coming down, stuff that people can use on the ground now, food, water, toiletries.
Parker says the public can still help to keep those trucks full in support of working families impacted by the storm by sending donations to actionnetwork.org. According to the governor's office, the state has provided more than 13 million meals, 47 million bottles of water, and 2.2 million gallons of fuel to those in need. As of Saturday, FloridaDisasterFund.org has raised more than $40 million to help those impacted by the storm. Parker says unions across the state will continue to chip in for as long as the need remains.
The labor movement itself, like unions, you know, we don't have the resources to rebuild houses and things like that, but we are doing everything that we can to assist the individuals, families, communities that have been affected by, in this case, another Cat 4 Hurricane Ian.
The state has listed tips to help those impacted, including resources for mental health and the Florida Small Business Emergency Bridge Loan Program. So far, the state has cleared debris from more than 2,800 miles of roadways. It also brought in around 375 Starlink satellite devices to provide internet. Other essentials, such as portable restrooms, are being shipped into areas still in need. For those interested in donating to any relief organizations, the National Center for Disaster Fraud is urging the public to be on the alert for fraudsters. They recommend donating to known charities and to use credit cards instead of cash to keep a record of the transaction.
This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview about Oregon Measure 112. If passed by voters next month, it would remove slavery as a punishment for crime from the Oregon Constitution. At 6... it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 50. Tomorrow's weather may be a little cloudy with some peaks of sunshine and a high of 65. Today in history, in 1987, the AIDS memorial quilt is first displayed during the Second National March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights. It's an enormous memorial to celebrate the lives of people who die from AIDS-related causes, and as of 2020, was the largest piece of community folk art in the world. The quote of the day is from AIDS activist Roger Lyon in testimony before Congress in 1983. Lyon said, quote, "I came here today with the hope that this administration would do everything possible to make every resource available. There is no reason this disease cannot be conquered. We do not need infighting. This is not a political issue. This is a health issue. This is not a gay issue. This is a human issue." World leaders have condemned Russia's brutal assault on civilian infrastructure, and Interior Secretary Deb Haaland wishes Americans a happy Indigenous Peoples Day. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
I am shocked and appalled by the vicious attack on Kiev and other Ukrainian cities. Russia once again has shown to the world what it stands for. It is terror and brutality.
World leaders, including Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas, denounced Russian military attacks on 10 Ukrainian cities. The UN has convened an emergency session of the General Assembly, and President Joe Biden spoke with Ukrainian officials about increased air defense systems.
You can count on us and me to continue this momentum to ensure that Indigenous communities have the resources they need to continue to thrive for future generations.
Department of the Interior Secretary and member of the Pueblo of Laguna, Deb Haaland, wished Americans a happy Indigenous Peoples Day. As supporters marked the occasion in cities across the country, including Boston, Indigenous Peoples Day is meant to recognize the history and resilience of Native Americans. Supporters say they want more than just a federal proclamation recognizing the day. They want it to replace the federal holiday celebrating Christopher Columbus, who is known for his barbaric treatment of Indigenous people. University of Florida students and faculty interrupted an event attended by the school's next potential president, Republican Senator Ben Sasse. Protesters say Sasse's opposition to same-sex marriage make him the wrong candidate for the job. Sasse responded by saying the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage is the law of the land. A small business advocacy group, the Job Creators Network Foundation, has filed a new lawsuit seeking to block President Biden's effort to forgive student loan debt for tens of millions of Americans. The group argues the administration failed to seek public input on the program, therefore violating federal procedures.
And so today, New York is acting, and these new laws today will ensure that we have more robust protections to stop people who pose a danger from obtaining guns.
New York Attorney General Letitia James applauded her state's landmark gun legislation signed in June, but a federal judge has now blocked key parts of the law, including efforts to ban guns from certain locations, like Times Square. James has appealed the ruling. Los Angeles City Councilwoman Nuri Martinez announced she would resign as the council's president following an audio leak in which she makes racist comments while discussing the city's redistricting process. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
President Joe Biden's signature on climate legislation is expected to reduce air pollution and kickstart a transition away from fossil fuels. But critics warn the Inflation Reduction Act does not provide enough support to enable low-income households to install more efficient heating and cooling systems that would lower their monthly utility bills. Eric Galatas has more on the story.
President Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act has been billed as the most significant legislation in U.S. history to tackle the climate crisis, strengthen American energy security, and lower utility bills. But some American households stand to benefit more than others. Luke Ilderton with Energy Outreach Colorado believes the new legislation is a good start, but argues current programs that help low-income households keep the heat on in winter and fans moving in summer will still be necessary.
Most of the funding will really go to more moderate to higher income low-income households and solar developers, wind developers, utilities. This really isn't going to be impacting the most vulnerable households.
In 2020, 27% of U.S. households had to choose between paying their utility bill or paying for other basic needs, including food and medicine, according to the Brookings Institution. Many turn off their heating and cooling systems to avoid being disconnected, which can be deadly for seniors and other vulnerable groups. Native American and Black households are twice as likely to experience energy insecurity than white households. Advocates expect the Inflation Reduction Act will reduce air pollution, resulting in 100,000 fewer asthma attacks by 2030. The measure includes rebates covering 50 to 100% of the cost of installing new electric appliances, including heat pumps, water heaters, clothes dryers, stoves, and ovens. Ilderton says some households could save $800 to $1,000 per year on their utility bills.
Those homes that are using inefficient or resistant electric heating, propane, those are using wood for their heating needs, will have the potential to save the most money when converting to high-efficiency electric equipment.
Households can tap up to $14,000 in rebates to install more energy-efficient windows, doors, electric heating and cooling systems, and other appliances. The measure also provides grants to help state and local governments adopt the latest building energy codes, which could save new homeowners in Colorado 20% on their utility bills. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
A historic site nomination by the Menominee Tribe in Wisconsin and Michigan could stop the Back 40 mine. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Authorities in Wisconsin and Michigan have now signed off on the Menominee Indian Tribe's nomination of a site to the National Register of Historic Places. Danielle Kading reports that's drawn backlash from some who say it's a veiled attempt to stop the Back 40 mine.
Historic preservation boards in Wisconsin and Michigan have approved the nomination of Onam Omot. The site includes the 60 Islands area where the tribe once lived on the Menominee River. Menominee Tribal Chairman Ron Korn Sr. says it contains the tribe's dance rings and burial mounds.
We're trying to protect our historic and cultural places. We're trying to protect, you know, the resting place of our ancestors.
It's also where Gold Resource Corporation wants to mine gold and other metals for the Back 40 project. Michigan Republican and State Senator Ed McBroom says listing the site would add more hurdles to the permitting process.
Suddenly, they're only up here to stop this mine, and this is just their latest trick in the bag to do so.
Korn says the tribe is opposed to the mine, but insists the nomination is about protecting cultural resources. A mining company executive says they will avoid disturbing archaeological sites. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A group of Native people and their allies gathered outside the Kansas City football team's stadium on Monday to call on the team to change its name and end the use of Native American imagery. The NFL Monday Night Football game between Kansas City and the Las Vegas Raiders was played on Indigenous Peoples Day. The Kansas City team released a statement in recognition of Indigenous Peoples Day, saying in part that the team is having dialogue with local and national groups to identify ways to educate and raise awareness of American Indian communities. Demonstrators say the statement to them holds no true meaning or value. Gaylene Krauser is the executive director of the Kansas City Indian Center and is one of the organizers of demonstrations held during football season.
I thought their statement is just more propaganda that they put out there to make the fans believe that what they're doing is okay by Native people, and it's not. And that's why we have to come out here and make that stand every single time so that doesn't get lost in the rhetoric.
Raiders fan Christian Cuevas came over to show his support.
And I seen this on TV that you guys want to change your name, but it's real out here. And I support it. You guys should change the name. You don't hear no other team being called, you know, Raiders or the other words, you know. But it's pretty interesting, and I believe you guys should change it.
Demonstrators are members of Not in Our Honor, a group of Native leaders, tribal college students, and Native community members in the greater Kansas City area. They advocate against the use of Native imagery in sports and media. In Native vote news, leaders of the five largest tribes in Oklahoma on Tuesday will publicly endorse Democratic candidate Joy Hoffmeister for governor of Oklahoma. Tribes have been at odds with current Republican Governor Kevin Stitt over a number of issues, including the historic U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the McGirt case, which reaffirmed reservation boundaries. The Cherokee, Chickasaw, Muscogee, Choctaw, and Seminole Nation say Hoffmeister respects tribal sovereignty and say she's committed to working with Oklahoma's nearly 40 federally recognized tribes. In a statement to press, Ditt's campaign says the governor has the support of thousands of tribal members across the state. The five tribes represent more than 800,000 tribal citizens. The tribes say they're looking to build safe communities, strong economies, a stable workforce, well-funded education, investments in infrastructure, health, wellness, families, and communities. The tribes are making the endorsement during an event in Oklahoma City. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new UN report reveals the extreme violence that Russia has perpetrated against Ukrainian civilians and children. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker. A content warning for listeners, this piece contains descriptions of sexual and other types of violence.
Hello, everyone. Fresh on the heels of the UN's report on Chinese human rights violations in Xinjiang comes a devastating indictment of Russian war crimes in Ukraine, presented by the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine on September 23rd. The UN report is based on-the-spot investigation, including visits to 27 towns and interviews with survivors. By now, we're all familiar with previous reports, mainly from Ukrainian sources, of horrific violence against civilians by Russian troops, murder, rape, mass executions, torture, sexual violence, and separation of children from parents. The investigating body was, quote, struck by the large number of executions in the areas that we visited. The report pays special attention to crimes against children, including, quote, documented cases in which children have been raped, tortured, and unlawfully confined. It also notes that explosive weapons, such as cluster bombs and rockets, used against civilian targets such as schools and hospitals, were responsible for most civilian deaths. As detailed as the report is, it leaves many other Russian actions for further investigation. Those include, according to the Norwegian judge who was part of the investigating group, the filtration camps set up in Russian-held territory for moving Ukrainians out of their country, and the destruction of Ukraine's economic assets. Left unsaid is the matter of Russian reparations for all those killed and maimed, a figure that is probably in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Still, the report does underscore the forced transfer of Ukrainians to Russia, where they were, quote, held for weeks in prisons. Interlocutors described beatings, electric shocks, and forced nudity, as well as other types of violence in such detention facilities. After being reportedly transferred into detention in the Russian Federation, says the report, some victims have disappeared. Attempts by the investigators to talk with Russian authorities were fruitless. If Moscow did have an answer, perhaps it was the sham elections that it held, contrary to international law in occupied territories. In the Kherson region, the Russian-appointed head made the astounding claim that by joining with Russia, quote, its people will be protected in every way, unquote. To judge from the number of people fleeing rather than voting, such nonsense persuades no one. The inevitable question, what, if anything, can be done to hold Russian officials, military and civilian, accountable for these crimes? One suggestion from a Ukrainian official is that a special tribunal be created to try Putin and his inner circle, as well as his top generals. The UN Human Rights Commission could condemn Russia or vote to exclude it from the commission. But let's face it, as happens so often, governments will vote or not on the basis of self-interest. Rather than offend Moscow, many UN members will sit on their hands, tisk-tisking the findings of the UN's investigation and avoid saying or doing anything to punish Russia, just as they have in response to the Bachelet report that cited China for crimes against humanity in Xinjiang. And of course, some of those same governments are themselves serious human rights offenders, guilty of war crimes or even crimes against humanity. Thus does the cycle of massive violence against innocent people repeat itself. The leading human rights crusader in Russia, Alexei Navalny, now serving a 9-year term in a maximum security prison, believes that only a fundamental change in Russia's governing structure can save his country. The threat to peace and stability in Europe is aggressive imperial authoritarianism, he says, endlessly inflicted by Russia upon itself. Post-war Russia, like post-Putin Russia, will be doomed to become belligerent and Putinist again. This is inevitable as long as the current form of the country's development is maintained, Only a parliamentary republic can prevent this. Navalny's thesis is that Russia's presidential system, with a strong-arm president and a blank-check parliament, must be discarded if Russia is to become a law-abiding member of the international community. A government that commits violence against its own people, not to mention its neighbors, is not going to change because of outside pressure, as China, India, Egypt, Turkey, and many other such governments demonstrate. Navalny may not be right that changing the structure of Russia's government is the solution, but he is surely right that only when imperial authoritarianism is finally rejected can Russia move to the path of, quote, harmony, agreement, and consideration of the interests of the whole society. That is the job of the Russian people, and reports out of Moscow suggest that frustration and anguish over the war are rising from both pro-war and anti-war people. Will Putin listen, or, as seems most likely, will he lash out with still more ferocious attacks on civilian targets? The best the West can do is follow the old advice, don't corner a wounded animal. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 11th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Eric Tegedoff, Tramel Gomes, and Eric Galatas. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282B Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.